Okay, so tonight we'll learn as a Le'iloi Nishmas of a Kalimer whose first yahrzeit is here with us. Crazy how quickly a year goes. Okay, so his neshama shavin aliyah. I want to share with you tonight an interesting. It's more than an article. It's more like an essay. So I occasionally buy books that I wonder why I buy them, and then they either sit on the bookshelf for a very long time, or they eventually get sold at yard sales, you know, before I moved to Israel, or get given away. So I bought this book called Subversive Sequels in the Bible, which I'll be honest, I actually didn't really know what the word subversive means, but it means disturbing.
Really?
I really didn't. I had to Google it. So anyway, for those that are in the same boat as me, it means disturbing. So I don't know. I bought it because it was a Magid Books, probably because it was at 40% sale and I was like building up my library. And once or twice I took it off the shelf and didn't actually read it. But I did remember vaguely that there was a long essay on this week's parsha. So last, I want to say either a Shabbos or Motzei Shabbos, I started reading the article and it was very long and it took me like till yesterday to fully finish it. But I did think that it was excellent. So I want to share it with you. Although there's one or two spots in it, I have my own set of like notes and initials. I don't write the author's full names anymore. It's just easier to like write their initials. But I considered putting someone's initials in next to it, anticipating like their feeling about it. So I guess I'll have to wait and see how it comes. So we've done this before in the sense that we've taken stories that appear in one place in Tanakh and then kind of appear a second place in Tanakh. And we've compared and contrasted and seen what happens. And sometimes the stories are very obvious. It's clear to anybody reading the story that the two of them are one and the same. Whether it's just that the narrative is very similar. So an example to that would be Avraham and Yitzchak. There's so much in each of their lives that mirrors it. You can really, you know, you can see it. Eliyahu and Elisha. So you have that. Then you have other times where it's clear that the two stories are mirrored to each other because the text itself borrows words from it. So in our many, many years of learning Megillas Esther, how many times would we sit there and read a pasuk and be like, wait a second, I've seen this before. Like, I know where this is going. And of course, it's meant by the author of the text to give us a sense of where the story is. This week's parsha, we have the word teva. Teva is only twice in all of Tanakh. The fact that that's only twice in Tanakh should tell us that there is a connection between Moshe Rabbeinu and his teva, so to speak, and the teva of Noach. But then there's sometimes where you have a story where like somehow the story is connected and yet it just doesn't, there seems to be no logical connection to it. And then we're forced to dig a little bit deeper. So what I want to do tonight is kind of take a look at one of those stories. It's a story that at first glance, the two stories have nothing to do with each other. But if we dig a little bit deeper, perhaps we could find a connection, which I think when learned properly can give us a really incredible insight into both of the stories. So let's take a look at the very first source. So this is a recap. We're starting Sefer Shmot. We are getting a recap of Sefer Bereshit. When I taught for a year, fifth grade, and we actually learned this parsha, and one of the students pointed out the reason why he believed, which I think is a good pshat, the Perek Aleph is a repeat of the first four or five psukim are a repeat of Sefer Bereshit. He's like, when you read the sequel of a book, often the book will give you information that comes, you know, to the reader, just in case you didn't read book number one, you'll get a little bit of a fill-in. again, it's a good question if it's really necessary. The Torah is not, you know, a Daniel Silva book, and there's no reason for it to kind of like do that for you. But it is a pshat. But Rashi gives a different explanation and says it's Lashon Chiba. God loves the Jewish people, and he wants to go back to the source to tell us. So Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Binyamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Ve'asher, Vayikol Nefesh, Yotze, Yerech, Yaakov, Shivim, Nefesh, VeYosef, Hayah, BeMitzrayim. There were 70 people, and Yosef was in Egypt. Okay, so Rashi's answer is a good one, and it's definitely a nice drasha, but I think that what we're going to do is, hopefully, as we go through the Psukim with the help of Judy Klitzner, the author of Subversive Sequels in the Bible, hopefully it'll give us a chance to better understand a different possibility. Yosef and all the brothers die, the whole generation dies. Sorry, me'od. And the land is full of them. So the Jewish people multiply greatly, and there is a lot of them, and they fill the land. So this pasuk is where we begin to enter into troubling waters. How is it possible that the king of Egypt, even if he's a new king, how is it possible that he didn't know Yosef? So Rashi tells us that either it's a machloket, either it was intentionally, right? He knew Yosef but chose to forget him. Or perhaps he really was a new king and he didn't know Yosef. Okay. So this pasuk is also a very hard one. He says to his people, behold, the Jewish people are, the nation of the Jewish people are rav v'atzum mimenu. They're greater and stronger than us. So interestingly, and I never really thought about this, but this is the first time that the Jewish people are called an am. There are a few times where they're called Bnei Yisrael in Sefer Bereshit, although I didn't have time to go through it. I suspect that the Bnei Yisrael that are mentioned in Bereshit really just refer to, like, literally the sons of Yaakov. And in those cases, they're called the Bnei Yisrael because there's a higher calling to them than the typical stories where they're just the sons of Yaakov. But they're called a nation. And ironically, who deems them a nation? It's Paro. Paro, the one that's fearful of the Jewish people, calls them a nation. And what does he say? Rav v'atzum mimenu. They are stronger and greater from us. Now, mistake on my part. I put this at the end, so you have to flip to the second page. Apologize. So if you're on the computer, just to scroll down, it's right before the English. Rav v'atzum mimenu, Shari Aron. The Shari Aron, he doesn't quote who this is from. He says, Perusho ha-pashut, the most simple translation, which, by the way, I did not find in any of the Mefarshim, is Yoter mima sha'anu rabim v'atzumim. So the Shari Aron says something that's crazy, but I don't think it's so crazy because I think this is the very nature of anti-Semitism. Rav v'atzum mimenu, Paro declares that they are greater and in number and stronger than we are. But that's impossible. Like, even if the Jewish people had multiplied to this point greatly, there's no way that they were larger than Egypt, the most powerful nation on the planet, with years and years and years of history before Yaakov came along and had his 12 sons. It seems to be impassable. So one possibility is that this is classically the way anti-Semitism works. Oh, the Jews are so many. They control the entire world. Yet, we're, I don't know, what are we, 14, 15 million people, if we're even so lucky. There's no way that we're rav v'atzum from anyone, right? So that's one possibility. But Judy Klitzner actually quotes a pshat that she said her students give her each year when they learn these psukim. Again, she agrees that it's probably not pshat, and it's likely not the best biblical translation, but they translate it as Rav v'atzum mimenu. They're great and strong mimenu from us. Meaning, how did the Jews become so strong? How did the Jews become so powerful? How did the Jews become so wealthy? So they took it from us. Rav v'atzum mimenu, right? They stole our wealth, which again is typical of anti-Semitism. How does it work? It works that the Jewish people, you know, are leeches on society. They somehow suck the system dry. Hava netchak malo pen yerbev ayaki tikrenim lchamav nosaf kum hual sonenu v'nilcham banu v'alam in ha'aretz. I just made it easier for everybody. All the underlines are just going to be the connections I found to the next story, at least in terms of language. So we have to think wisely. We have to deal with them. Because if there's a war, there'll be a fifth column, and they'll fight with us, and they'll leave the land. Now also, why is that so bad? If you're afraid of them, is the greatest gift. Let them leave the land. Right? Why is it that that's... That's what's put in. But again, that's anti-Semitism. We hate them, but yet we don't want to let you go. So they put taxes upon them, or officers of tax upon them, and they build cities, storage cities for Paro, Pitom, and Ramses. And the more that they afflicted them, the more that they grew, and they were disgusting in the eyes of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people were disgusting in their eyes, or they were disgusted by the Jews. The Egyptians worked the Jewish people very, very hard. Now, one possibility of how to read these psukim is that there's plan A, B, and C. Plan A was charge taxes. Hopefully, that would bother them. Plan B was have them build these storage cities. Hopefully that would stunt their growth. And then plan C was full out slavery. And so they make their lives bitter with hard work, bricks and mortar, all the field all the work in the field that they made them do was befarech, was hard. Okay, plan D. Paro says to the Mialdot Ivriot, whose names are Shifra and Pua. I'm sorry, I feel bad. I went very fast. Does anybody have any questions? No. Okay. So this is the first like little thing that I'm going to throw in. I'm not even sure why it's necessary, but I didn't think it was necessary, but I thought it was definitely cute if you like this kind of thing. Shifra and Pua, if you take the letters of their name, you actually have all the letters in there, plus the Shin and the Vav of Paro's name. So I don't know why it's necessary, but Judy Klipner says that is actually, you could indicate from the fact that the names are so similar that there is like a battle between them. So I don't know, you could take that one or, yeah.
So you say, and I agree, that this is the maybe a standard or a base case for the notion of anti-Semitism, how you implement it. You say there's a lot of them, they're bad for us, then you tax them, and you subjugate them, and you enslave them. I don't know. Okay. But it seems also, not to knock ourselves, but like we seem to allow this to happen. I don't mean that we allowed the Holocaust to happen, you know, how by that, but it doesn't suggest that there was any pushback of any sort, any type, no notion of that. And I don't know if we're supposed to understand something from that or just go, okay, they were mean to us and we bowed our heads and we became slaves.
Well, I mean, I do think that, I think sadly that is the history of anti-Semitism, so long as we find ourselves in exile. Right, like we don't really find, you know, sometimes we find favor in like certain people's eyes, and you know, which is like the Megillus Esther story, and like the day is saved. But when it's all done, right, we generally do, even when we're saved, we find ourselves back in a precarious situation once again. That's like best case scenario. Here is worst case scenario, which is, you know, there is a Holocaust of its generation, and then what ends up happening? So like the tattered remains of the Jewish people pick themselves up. Okay, God was, you know, much more miraculous here, at least openly, than at the end of the Holocaust of our day. So the Jews do leave in a good place financially, as opposed to refugees that have nowhere to go. But we don't really stick up for ourselves, right? Like, you don't find all that much in Jewish history.
No. And that's clearly that's been problematic for us, which is why we're only 14, 15 million people instead of 100 million or whatever number we could have been had we never been, you know, murdered on a regular basis. But, you know, the Torah is, you know, lessons to us for all generations. And apparently the lesson to us is accept being subjugated. Forget, you know, okay, we're there. They're not in their homeland, but it's like, this is what happens, and don't even offer up any, you know, pushback. Just, you know, go along with it, and you'll get killed, and hopefully one day you'll be fine. Right. It's not really a challenge to you, it's more of a challenge to us.
No, right. Okay. Did the Jews, Jews consider themselves in exile at this point?
Yeah, I think so. Meaning the psukim indicate in at the end of Vayigash and Vayechi that the Jews were going into exile. Like they and exile is any time we leave Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, I think that's, you know, again, that could be the message that is, you know, that's implicit in all of this, is that like the Jewish people belong in Eretz Yisrael, and so long as they're in Chutz La'aretz, they're going to always find themselves in these like in these tight spots.
But don't chase them out, you know, of Eretz Yisrael, or force them to go to Egypt. I mean, it's the way things worked out. I guess to David's point, yeah, I don't know, starting at this point, I don't know what the mindset was, right, that this got rolled over. If they were, up until then, they have green cards and not quite full citizens, but, you know, they're pretty interested here, but we got some mode that they established themselves. What made them say, oh, okay, well,
Abraham battled the four kings and five kings, and Shimon Levi killed all of them, but all of a sudden here, it's like, we're screwed.
Yeah, but I think that's like, that happens in Bavel, and it happens in Germany, and it happens in Europe.
This is the first time on a national basis. Your point is that this is the first time they're called Am, and this is the lesson Torah is giving us. Just take it. Guys, again, you didn't write this.
I'm
not saying you wrote this.
Yeah, I wouldn't take credit.
Very different times than Abraham's time, right? This is also, you know, just like any other time that we get oppressed to such a horrific extent, it doesn't happen overnight. It's a slow process. It's psychological. You know, it's not like it just instantly, one day you're a big part of the economy and society and whatever it is, even if you're living on your own. And the next day, poof, you're making bricks and building pyramids.
Doesn't it seem like they were fooled or lulled into this false sense of security, and then they suddenly they woke up and they were, I mean, they were.
I buy into that. I
smart people.
Buy into that.
They were. It just seems so incredibly weak-minded and
the danger of going. But then at the same time, look at the flip side. In modern times, look at the Six-Day War.
Right. I think that's probably the point. The point is that the way it works for the Jewish people is, so long as they find themselves in Galus, things happen that just don't make any sense. And they, you know, they find themselves constantly, or we find ourselves constantly in like these really tough spots. And when we come back to live in Eretz Yisrael, things are just different. Like, it's not different. You know, it's the Avos, we see that. You know, there's Meek Yaakov in Haran, and then there's Mighty Avraham in Eretz Yisrael. And then you see the same thing with the Jewish people. When they come out, and when they come back into the time, in the times of Yoshua, you know, there is the mighty conquest of the land. And then there's many other times throughout Tanakh, you know, even though it goes up and down with the way the Jewish people, you know, are connected to God and their subsequent successes or failures. But then, you know, they end up in Chutz La'aretz, and every time, you know, they end up making it to the top, and then, you know, it all comes crashing down.
But it's also interesting that there's no mention of a disconnect to Hashem here.
Yeah, I mean, we have to also remember that God promised that this was going to happen, right? You're going to go down to...
Did they deserve it? I mean, did this generation deserve what happened to them? Yeah, it was going to happen. But you were usually told, they stopped doing this, they stopped doing that, they started to integrate, they started to intermarry, they started to...
You have a relationship with Hashem, it doesn't say that they don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
omission. It's pretty bad what happened to them.
Yeah, so it's an interesting question why God all of a sudden is out of the story, which we'll come back to in just a little bit. I guess it's a point well taken. Rav Soloveitchik says that there was no reason for there to have been this galus. They could have been yotze with the 20 years or so that they spent, or the 21 years that they spent outside of Israel during, by Lavan and on their way back. And if not for Mechiras Yosef, that would have been it. Like, the Jewish people would have been fine. So you could argue that Mechiras Yosef leads to all of this. And that was their big sin, the sin of disunity, which leads to, 210 years in Egypt, of which a lot of it is spent in slavery. Okay.
The connection between the 21 years and then the 10 brothers who did it, so it's 10 times the amount, so it's 210.
So I don't know about the brothers, but Rabbi Foreman does have a thing about like micro macro, and he was like 21, 210, it was like for a small family versus big for a big nation. There is actually one little problem with it. It's not really 21 years, it's really 22 years because that's how long they're out. But Rabbi Foreman kind of like tiptoes around that. They're back in Eretz Yisrael maybe at a certain point, and that's why it's only 21. Okay, so...
Into the 22nd.
Yeah.
Rabbi Kalman would have liked to play on the numbers here.
Yeah. It's a good gematria. Okay, fine. Let's move on, because we have a lot to still do. So what happens? There are these two women, Shema Achat Shifra, v'Shema Sheni Pua. V'yomer b'yaladchem ati v'yot v'ritem alav na'im, imbenu v'amitem otov v'imbati v'chaya. Pasuk Tet Zayin says the following. I want you to, when you help the children be born, and you see them on the birth stool, if it's a boy, kill them, and if it's a girl, let them live. Irony, we won't spend any time on this, but irony is that it's the bat v'chaya that actually saves the Jewish people, right? By leaving the girls alive, it's Miriam and some other women that allow the Moshe to live. Pasuk Yud Zayin is a reversal of Pasuk Tet Zayin. He says Uri'item alav na'im, and what does it say? Vatirena hamialadot. Now that's not the same word. That's yarei, to fear. If it was to see, it would be vatirena hamialadot. But they would not have seen God, but they fear. It's a play on words. He says see, and they turn the see into fear of God. He declares Zamitem Oto, and then they Vatchayena. So Pyre calls him out on it. Why did you do this? Why did you save the children? And then they go on and say, what do you want from us? The women are different, blah, blah, blah. God is good to them. The Jewish people are great in number and very strong. And then we're told in Pasuk, Chaf Aleph, Vahik Yaru Hamialdot Adolkim Vayaslaim Batim. Because they feared God, God made them houses. So Paro decrees that it's on the books now, not it's quietly done by the Mialdot. This is plan E. The fifth one is all the boys that are born should be thrown into the Nile and all the girls should be spared. Pasuk Aleph of the next Perek is Vayelech Ish Mibet Levi, Vaykacha Bat Levi. We once again have no named people. And yet, when we finish this story, we have someone who's named. Bat Paro saves this child and names the child Moshe Kimin Amayim Mishitihu. Okay. End of Shmot. Okay, so now, if you looked down at the next source, you've already figured out that the story that we're going to connect this to is Migdal Bavel. Now, Migdal Bavel, the tower that's built, seems to be, at first glance, nothing like this story at all. Perhaps the only connection at first glance that you would have is that what? Right, what's the only connection between the two stories at first glance? Right, without digging.
First
first glance I saw was 70 nations and 70 people going into Mitzrayim.
Okay, but we don't know that there's 70 nations, meaning that's in the end, midrashically, we're told, although that's an interesting point, right? That they do become 70 nations and there's 70 Jews. What's the connection between them, especially if the stories are connected to each other? But the only connection that I could think of at first glance is that they both build, right? They build Arei Miskinot LeParo, and the other people build they attempt to build a big building. And yet, if you look at the underlines, there's so many linguistic connections that it's hard to ignore it. So, Vayikol Ha'aretz Afachad Udvarim Achadim, everybody was one. One nation, one voice, one language. And they left Mikedem, where they were originally, and they looked for a big place that everybody could fit, and they settle in Eretz Shinar. So what happens? They, each man says to himself, Hava nilbana leveinim. Now, isn't it interesting that the word hava is used by both of them as like the way of like, oh, let's come up with a good plan and we're going to build bricks. Right, we have Levenim and Chemar, right? If you look above, we have Bechomer uBilveinim. It's the same materials that they're building with. Interestingly, though, the materials are listed in the reverse order. Levenim and Chemar here, and there it's Bechomer uBilveinim. Vayomru hava nivne lanu ir. What do they do? They say, let's build for ourselves a city, and it'll have a tower that's going to go all the way up to the sky, and we'll make for ourselves a name, lest we spread out. Penafutz al pnei chala aretz is pretty similar to where we have up there, pen, and we have yefrotz. So again, it's very similar language. And also, we have there Ba'alamina Aretz. Here we have Al-Panechala Aretz. Vayir Hashem lirot et ha'ir v'et ha'migdal asher banu b'nei Adam. God comes down and sees the city and the migdal that the people had built. Interestingly, we always talk about Migdal Bavel. But if you look at it carefully, there is a great deal of focus, not on the Migdal only, but on this city that's built. And if you take a look at the end of Pasuk Chet, Vayachtelu Livnot Ha'ir, what they didn't finish building was the city. That seems to be the focus of it. Okay, and up top we have, what are they building? Arei Miskinot LeParo. Also interesting why that is. God says, look at what happens. I give them the gift of one language, one nation, and this is what they do. I'm not going to let them do it. Let's go down. I'm going to go down, or we will go down, and we will mix up their language so that they don't understand what they're talking about. And they become, it's called Bavel, which comes from the word Balal, to be mixed up. God mixes up all the languages. And then Pasuk Yod, a Pasuk that you could easily ignore, but it's actually important to note that the same way in Shmot, we start off with names, the first couple of Pesukim, and then Perek Bet, we come back to names. Here, we start with names. If you were to read Perek Yod is chock full of names. And then Pasuk Yod of Perek Yod Aleph is Eile Toldot Shem, Kama Shem B'ma'at Shana. That sounds a whole lot like Pasuk Ted Vav above, Asher Shem Achat Shifra V'Shem Hasheni Pua, the double language of Shem once again. So what's the connection between these two stories? Well, actually, they're both his name. Eile Toldot Shem. These are the generations of Shem. Shem B'me'at Shana. But the very fact that we have Shem twice in very close, very, very close, and then above we have Shem twice, almost as close. Again, if that was the only connection in terms of language between the two psukim, or between the two stories, I would kind of feel like we're stretching it a little bit. I hear that, but that would not help us.
No.
Oh, actually, the truth is, no. You know what? The Eila Shmot, we have that up in Pasuk Aleph, right? The Eila Shmot, and here we have Eila Toldo Shame. So if you don't want to buy, you know, the Shame and Shame, so that's another one up there. How do the stories connect? So, this is what Judy Klitzner says. She says perhaps that Noach explains the problem and Shmot contains the solution. So then what's the problem? What went wrong in this story? So Rashi says, Safa achat l'shon ha-kodesh. They all spoke Hebrew. Udvarim achadim ba'u eitzel achat v'amru lo kol heimenu she'avor lo atal yonim na'le l'rakia v'nasimu milchama. Let's go fight God. Davar acher al yechido shel olam. They were fighting upon the oneness of God. Davar acher, dvarim achadim. Amru achal elef v'tarnav shanim. Once every 1500 and some odd years, once every 1600 some odd years, the skies are going to open up. Mitmotei k'shem shasav mabul bo v'nasa lo smocho. Let's build a dam. It's amazing because the flood had just happened not that long ago. So if it happens once every 1600 years, why is it my problem? Right, my great 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 grandchildren probably won't even have to deal with it. So why do I have to deal with it? But okay, that's Rashi. Let's take a look at the Netziv. The Netziv says something completely different. Rosho Bashmain, Zev Vadai lo yaleh al hadat sheyeh ir achat l'chol olam. Did they really think that one city could hold the entire world? Ela kisvurim shekayu kol arim smuchot v'teflut l'oto ha'ir shebah ha'migdal. The idea was, obviously, it would be impossible for the entire world to settle in this one valley. So what is it that they're looking to do? What they're looking to do is create a metropolis with this one Migdal in the middle, and everybody would look up to it. And as far as you could go, even if you're hundreds of miles away, since they're in this Bika, this flat area, people would see it, and people would know it, and people would always look towards there, and everybody would be connected. Shaloyu nufradim be'eretz acheret. Alkein itzrachshi rosho b'shamayim. That's why it had to be super, super high. They say that the CN Tower, which is the really tall building in Toronto, you can see it for hundreds and hundreds of miles. And certainly from the CN Tower, Big Brother is watching, you can see for hundreds of miles as well. So perhaps that's, you know, this is really what it is. It's a Big Brother type society where everybody can see everybody, everybody is being watched, and they're all part of this one unified society. Says, then it's, if they wanted complete uniformity in the world, everybody would be on the same page. Right, and that's what's happening. And the problem with this is, in theory, it works, except often what happens is the ideology takes over and the people are forgotten, and then it all goes down the toilet. So that's why God is not a big fan of Migdal Bavel, and that's why God breaks it up. So if that's the case, how does that connect to our story? So our story is a similar story where there's a society that's trying to create uniformity. The Jews are different. They don't like it that way. So how do you blot them out? So you enslave them. So instead of enslaving them to an ideology, which is what happens in Noach, they're really enslaved. So if you take a look at the English, Nachum Sarna, Exploring Exodus, he explains why what Paro did was so bad. He says, organized in large work gangs, they become an anonymous mass, depersonalized, losing all individuality in the eyes of their oppressors. Perhaps if Soloveitchik says it even better in Reflections of the Rav by Rav Bezdin, in corporate slavery, however, and in passive oppression precludes all human association. There is no friendship or human emotion. Think Yosef. Yosef was a slave also. He was a slave to who? To Potiphar, and yet in his enslavement to Potiphar, what happens? There is a relationship. There is a personal peace. But in mass slavery, it is depersonalized. It's a faceless prison with the inmates reduced to number identification. Sounds a lot like the Holocaust. And so that's exactly what happens. That is what happens. The Jews lose hope. Not only do the Jews lose hope, but the Jews lose any chance of being people. So how does it change? It changes by the introduction of Shifra and Pua. Shifra and Pua are Mialdot HaIvriot. So take a look at the Malbim. Last explanation. Feel free to take a look at the Ibn Ezra in your own time. The Malbim. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim. Kifia Pshat Amar LaMitzri Amar LaHaMitzriot. He says, Mialdot HaIvriot. Who are they? They're the Mialdot of the Ivriot. They're not Jews. Shayu Mialdot HaIvriot. Hayu Shnei Minei Mialdot. Shaya Oseket Ima Yoshevet Al Mashper Lotzi Avlad. There were two types. And so when Paro speaks to the Egyptian ladies, he's speaking to the two types of midwives. One is Oseket Ima Yoshevet Al Mashper Lotzi Avlad. She's basically the doctor. She's the one that's birthing the child. Vasheni Shahaya Oseket Ima Olad Lechrot Tiburo Lasot Sarcho. The second one is the nurse that helps cut the umbilical cord and take care of the baby, care for the child. That's what happens there. And he's speaking to the two kinds. But what's happening is that Paro is talking to the Mialdot HaIvriot, who happen to be perhaps Mitzriot. And what is he saying to them? He's saying to them, you have to continue in my ways of being inhumane. And so, says Judy Klitzner, the antidote to Paro's inhumanity is to be humane. When you have no power at all, you can find power in being a human being. Right? We see stories of that in the Holocaust, of people that were stripped of everything, and yet they did an act of kindness to other people within the midst of the Holocaust. Shifra and Pua decide to be individuals. They decide that they're not, which is even more amazing, according to the Malbim's pshat, that Shifra and Pua are prototypes, not names. But the Torah tells us, Shema Achad Shifra v'Shema Sheni Pua, by defying the word of Paro, what are they doing? They're saying that they're going to be named people, not numbers. And by being named people and not numbers, what they introduce back into the story is the person or the entity that's missing. And who is that? V'tirena ha-mialdot et ha-elokim. They introduce God back into the story and remind us that there can be godliness even in the worst of places. And in fact, it's through their brave actions that Moshe Rabbeinu is saved and the Jewish people are ultimately saved. I think that that's an amazing, amazing way of looking at the story. And I think by looking at Noach and seeing the goals of the Egyptian of the Dor HaFlaga, we have a better idea of what it is that Paro wanted to accomplish. I thought that this was a particularly appropriate topic for a shir in memory of Rabbi Kelemer, because I think that Rabbi Kelemer was so much, but what he's probably known to most of us as was by the Shem Shel Chesed, that no matter what happens, and no matter what's going on, we have to have that chut shel chesed, no matter how tired, no matter how spread and stretched we are, that's what's expected of us. So I hope that his neshama should get nachas from all of us, and he should continue to be a neilitz yosher for us, and we should find many opportunities to do chesed in our daily lives. Have a wonderful Shabbos.